Near-Death Experience Podcast, an ongoing exploration of spiritually transformative experiences, including NDEs and other phenomena, in order to elucidate the ineffable and better understand our spirituality. All episodes are available at ndepodcast.org. The views expressed and opinions given by the individual hosts and guests are not necessarily those of NDE Podcast, the NDERF, any sponsors, or for that matter, anyone else. In the end, the only opinion that really matters is yours.
Welcome to Near-Death Experience Podcast, the official source of audio accounts for the Near-Death Experience Research Foundation. I'm Chaz Hathaway, author of Life in the Spirit World, What Near-Death Experiences May Teach About Life on the Other Side, and also the music album Home. Today we're going to share the experience of Cynthia from NDERF.org, the Near-Death Experience Research Foundation website. Cynthia says, "In 1973, at the age of 20, I was in a serious automobile accident. I had been in a tavern, drinking with friends, which had become a regular habit of mine on the weekends during that time of my life. A good friend of mine had insisted on giving me a ride home, but for some reason I made a life-changing decision to take a ride home with an acquaintance, Dennis, that I had known through other close friends of mine. These are the things that I knew about Dennis. He had attended the same schools that I had for as long as I can remember. He was a quiet, kind young man. He loved his muscle car. He loved his girlfriend, with whom he had recently broken up. From the moment I got into the car with Dennis, he began talking about the girl he loved so desperately. I was sensitive to his situation because I had recently broken off a bad relationship that I was still emotionally connected to. I remember that during those few minutes before the collision, I felt so very sorry for Dennis as he began to cry. We approached and then passed through the intersection where we were supposed to have turned. As the engine revved and then screamed, I remember thinking how depressed he must be. My next realization was of being in a void, traveling through space, being pushed and pulled at the same time. I was traveling at such an enormous rate of speed that I could feel friction on my body. This wasn't the body that I was used to, but it was a body of some sort, an element or an energy maybe. The speed was increasing continuously. I don't know how long I traveled because time was no longer relevant. I was aware that I was being directed towards something important. The light was in the distance. Before I could reach the light, I came to a plateau. On this plateau, there were people of light, transparent, in long flowing robes, or maybe they were not robes, but part of their bodies. I knew that these beings were my ancestors, people that I had not known in my lifetime, but that were connected to me nonetheless. They were all smiling and happy to see me, as though they had been waiting for me. They were glad that I was there so that they could tell me the secret that they all knew. One of them came forward to greet me. She told me that she had something to tell me. I don't remember her speaking actual words, more with thought. I do remember her speaking one word, though. It was a simple, one-syllable, two-letter word like ib or er, a word that I had never heard before. I remember wondering how there could be such a word, so simple, yet undiscovered by man. Only two letters. At the very moment she said this word, I knew the reason for everything. It was as if I was connected with all of the other beings, The ones I saw there on the plateau, the ones that I did not see but were somewhere in the distance in the place I had not yet traveled, near the light, and the ones I had left behind on earth. Everyone, everything. I looked back over my shoulder, away from the plateau, and I could see it all. I realized the reason for everything. I had all knowledge. I turned back to look at my greeter, and she was still smiling at me. I saw everyone standing behind her and felt a sense of wonder and awe that can't be described. They were all smiling and nodding. They were happy that I understood. I felt an excitement, happiness, and love that can't be expressed on this earth. I knew that I had to return to my life. I had no choice. There was no question about it. I could see what had to be done. When I became aware that I was in the hospital, my body hurt with such pain that it was almost unbearable. I was later told that while I was in the emergency room, they thought they had lost me more than once. Even after I was conscious during my first week's stay in the intensive care unit, my friends and family thought I might not pull through. But from the moment I was aware, I knew that I would live. I spent 2 months in the hospital and had many ups and downs. I found out that Dennis was killed in the wreck. I overcame many emotional and physical scars caused during this time of my life. I have lived my life between then and now and have made many mistakes and wrong decisions. I have experienced happy times and made many good decisions. In other words, I have experienced life. I have tried many times to remember the simple word that explained everything, but I know I never will. The knowledge that I had briefly is not meant for this life. When we pass over, we will all understand and become part of the light. I know this because I was allowed a glimpse of our afterlife. That is the end of Cynthia's account. And what an interesting account it is. Not only does she die and go to the other side, but she has the experience of, as she describes it, knowing everything, understanding everything, the reason for everything, all knowledge, even feeling connected with anybody and everybody. And even in the describing of the experience afterward and how she went on to live life and fulfill her dreams, to make mistakes, to, you know, make good decisions and bad ones. She says, in other words, I have experienced life. Now, as she described, she was about 20 at the time, and the experience happened in 1973. That means she was probably born in about 1953, which means that she is approaching, 70 now? Almost 70 years old, so she's lived a full life. And though I don't know exactly when she recorded this account, I'm guessing it's probably been 10 or 15 years. We'll just guesstimate 10 years, okay? Because if I remember right, this is in a list of accounts that happened around, or that were recorded in about 2007-ish. Anyway, the point is, I think it's fair to say that she's lived a full, meaningful life. And though, as she said, she's made many mistakes, she feels as though she has experienced life. I'm going to go out on a limb and suggest that sense of having experienced life is probably her spirit's way of saying you did what you came here to do, or that you're on the right track at least. And while I wouldn't suggest that, you know, she's ready to go and it's time for her to go, because it's probably not. If you're alive, you still have reason to be alive. But the bulk of her purpose may have been fulfilled in this, the life that followed. What I find interesting is that she has, in this all-knowing moment, a recognition. When she's on the other side, she has this experience of knowing everything, feeling connected with everything, and in that, she recognizes, she says, I knew that I had to return to my life. I had no choice. And I don't think by that she means there was no agency in the matter, but I think she's saying it had to be done. She said, there was no question about it. I could see what had to be done. It was as if she was, you know, taking a step out of her life for a time, being filled with all knowledge and recognition of everything that ever she would need to know. And in that knowledge, she realized, well, of course I've got to go back. I have not completed what I set forth to do. And while most people do not have that experience of the all-knowingness and recognizing what she needs to do, they're usually told by someone, you're not done yet. You've got to go back. You've got to finish. And so in her case, she got to actually experience it for herself, which of course that knowledge and recognition, even the one syllable word that, you know, kind of seemed to trigger her full memory and knowledge, none of that could be recalled after she returned. Her body again placed that veil over her memory, and she's not able to recall what exactly she knew, what exactly she remembered, and what exactly that experience of everything, connection with everything, was for her. But she remembers having the experience, which is valuable for our purposes, because we can now see from that experience that this is what people will experience, or at least that's the way she describes it. We're all going to know, and we will all become part of the light. We will know everything, or have this sense of knowing everything. We will have that. But as she puts it, that knowledge that I had briefly is not meant for this life. So that's interesting to me. This life is about living. That life is about knowing and understanding. But there is another aspect to this that I haven't touched on, and that is that sense of being connected with all other beings. Both the people there, which she describes as being her ancestors, most of which she had, or possibly all of which, she had not met in her mortal life, but that were still connected to her. Her ancestors were a very important part of that knowledge. You know, when I hear stuff like that, it makes me think that many of the indigenous peoples of countries around the world, continents around the world, may have been closer to correct in their understanding of their connection to their ancestors than we've often given them credit for. As I have mentioned many times, I am a Christian, and I strongly hold to that, a member of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, specifically. But in the Christian tradition or history, in the history of Christianity as a whole, much of the quote-unquote missionary work that took place around the world included a lot of squelching of the traditional belief in ancestors, or that the people who had gone before were still in some way connected to the individuals that they're preaching to. And it is really quite unfortunate that that squelching took place, because it could very well be that their native religions and connection to their ancestors came because of some of their near-death experiences, where they felt and sensed that connection with their ancestors and carried that tradition on to their children and their children's children, so on. leaving a sense of connection to ancestors with the society as a whole. You think of African traditions. I spent 2 years in Africa, and that was the traditional religion was reaching out to one's ancestors. You think of ancient Asian traditions, Chinese and Japanese. The connection to ancestors is very strong. Native American, very, very strong connection to ancestors and the spirits who had gone before. And while Christianity went through a dark age, if you will, where the Crusades went about to force people to be baptized, to understand, you know, the cross and its importance and so forth, squelching all of the traditional beliefs, or as many as they could squash, it was so pompous of us as Christianity as a whole, as society, Western civilization, to quash the good with the bad. And I don't deny that there was bad in many of these traditions, you know, human sacrifice and some weird things in many such traditions. Certainly anything evil or wrong, it's good that it was, you know, broken off from these traditions, but the good went with it. A lot of the good went with it, which is terribly unfortunate. And the reason I bring this up is because there's so much of contention in the world. There is so much of division. And most people's idea of, you know, if you ask them, what would it take for us to become united? It's an idea that, you know, if you were to break it down and really look at it, it would basically be saying, if only everybody would think and feel and see the way things I see them, then we would have this perfect unity. And obviously when you hear it in those words, it sounds ludicrous. You're like, of course that's not how it works. Of course, you know, it's not, we need just everybody to see the way I see things. We need everybody to understand politics the way I understand politics. We need everybody to be of my religion. Or we need everybody to see things and hear things and feel the things that I feel. I don't want to feel what they feel. I don't want to see what they see. I want them to feel what I feel and see what I see. And obviously that will never work. That will never happen. Because that's not where love comes from. Love penetrates all the differences. And not only penetrates in the way of cutting us from them, but rather engulfs them. Anybody who's had a happy marriage all their life knows that while there has to be a level of shared values, a level of shared understanding. Because obviously if one person is a psychotic killer and abusive individual, you don't embrace that because that is not coming from a place of love. But to anyone who has been married for a long time, you know that there are differences and that those differences are not divisions between us, but they are complements between us. And that we love not in spite of our differences, but with our differences. We embrace those differences. And yes, there are always things that we see as faults, as weaknesses in each other, in our companions or whatever. But we can embrace them with those weaknesses so that when they are prepared, they can work on those weaknesses. They can work on changing what they know is imperfect about themselves in their time. We don't have to push that out of them. Of course, as parents, as teachers, or any position where we need to be teaching, and we have, you know, an authoritative position where we have to be imparting our wisdom on the next generation, for example, as parents, there does have to be correction, and there does have to be more than just an acceptance of you know, their weaknesses and so forth. We have to teach them and then love them through it. It's kind of the perfect example even there, because even in a position where we do have to correct and we do have to change, a parent can understand how love can be unconditional. Yes, I want you to work on your grades, but despite whatever happens with school, I love you without fail, without the slightest, you know, hesitation. I absolutely, undyingly, unconditionally love you. And I want you to get your grades up. It's hard to extend that level of unconditional love to those strangers beyond our view, but it's possible, and it's part of our purpose for being here. And I think that's one of the reasons, or that's the reason I want to bring this up, because I think it's important for us to recognize that whether we know it or not, we have an undying, unbroken, unbreakable connection with every other person on the planet. I've been reading a book. I'm only probably a third of the way into the book. It's a heartbreaking book and painful, but one that I'm reading as kind of taking a bitter pill about I think it's called something like, if I remember right, an indigenous history of the United States or a history of the United States from an indigenous perspective, something, an indigenous people's perspective. Basically, the founding of America from the perspective of, or at least seeking to, you know, seeing the point of view or the situation of Native Americans, the Aztecs, the Olmecs, you know, well, Olmecs were much prior, but Aztecs, Mayans, Native Americans of all the different various tribes and so forth. And it is heartbreaking, heartbreaking. We had no right to do what we did to them. No right whatsoever. And, you know, not to say that their societies were perfect. They certainly weren't. They had many of the problems that we brought in as well, including slavery and other things, and I don't justify that in the least. But it's important for us to recognize our responsibility in history and realize where our people made mistakes or absolutely, what's that term, crimes against humanity. Obviously, we are not necessarily personally responsible for what our ancestors did or what our society did, but we do need to take responsibility for the consequences. And it's just heartbreaking to see what took place. But the point is that those people that we once oppressed or now oppress even, are still connected with us so intimately and so divinely that all of our divisions in this life, be they, you know, political, be they religious, be they, borders, country borders, whatever our differences, even the divisions of those who have personally hurt us, those divisions in the eternal scheme of things are nothing. They are nothing. And the eternal brotherhood and sisterhood of mankind is far more literal than we ever can see and recognize in this life. Near-death experiences attest to that fact. We are so intimately connected that it is as if every person we ever see is us in another lifetime of sorts. We should try to see the divinity in those around us. If I'm not mistaken, that term, namaste, is a recognition of that. The divine in me recognizes or salutes or greets the divine within you. Why can we not see that? Maybe we're not expected to actually remember or even sense it to the degree that we one day will be able to sense it. But being aware of it, despite not being able to feel it, can take us a long way in being able to overcome or at least be okay with the differences between us. I could never embrace communism, for example, as a ideology that I would ever embrace. But can I embrace communists? Can I embrace the fact that they embrace their ideology? Can I embrace, let's just look in our society, Wiccans, the traditional witch and warlock religions? Can I embrace those people? Can I embrace the child molester? Now kind of the rubber's hitting the road a little bit. That's a hard one. Because what they're doing is wrong, and they should be stopped. Those who drive the child sex slave industry that is on the black market today, even in America and across the world. Can I embrace those people? Well, first off, I cannot and never will embrace what they're doing, and I will fight to my dying breath what they are doing. But can I embrace those people? Can I recognize the divinity within them? To know that they are as divinely connected to God as I am. Whew, that's hard. But at some point, at some level, I've got to. That doesn't mean, again, it does not mean that I'm going to allow their behaviors. I will fight it to my dying breath. But I don't have to hate. I don't have to create deeper division in individuals. I don't have to refuse my forgiveness of them. And that's not easy. I can't imagine what a person goes through who perhaps has a child, let's just say a daughter, who has been, you know, I think of somebody like Elizabeth Smart, if you read her story. Oh, just absolutely devastatingly horrible what she went through. But her parents, can you imagine being in their shoes? Can you forgive? And I only use her for an example because she has chosen herself to publicize her story and so forth. There are many who prefer the privacy of people not knowing what they've been through, and that's totally okay. I totally understand. People are suffering at the hands of others. And yes, it's not hard to embrace those who have suffered, and we should. But can we embrace those who perpetrated the horrors? You might say it's the acid test of our ability to love. It's where the rubber hits the road. It's where we find out how truly we embrace love And it's also where we come to the point where we can find the difference between loving the sinner while hating the sin. Now, some people cringe at that term because it's come to be applied to many sinister divisions, and that's unfortunate. But the idea of someone doing something unthinkable and yet still loving that person and yet not being willing to accept what they have done. It's a three-way dance that not one of us has the perfect solution to. Not one of us. We're in an imperfect mortal world, a very difficult, painful, tragic world where the evils being perpetrated cannot be justified and they have to be brought to justice. They have to be. But we can't hate. We can't allow the hatred of the activities to burn us from the love that we came from and that we are going to return to. And it's hard because we are not in a position to be able to see right now, to see their life reviews and to see why they became what they became or what they went through that put them in a state of mind to be able to commit such atrocities against other people. But we can recognize that that understanding is out there and that God has that understanding. We can be not okay with the wrong that happens around us, but we can learn to love through the hatred that surrounds us. And it's our duty as beings on this earth, in the suffering, right in the sludge of the suffering, to be able to extend love and to be able to extend mercy and protection and security and love again and a willingness to help and heal and patch the differences. What our society, and by our society I mean American society and many other Western societies, perpetrated against other societies that were before us, are often genocide. And we can't deny that. And we have to acknowledge that and not hate ourselves for it. But we've got to overcome the things that allowed us or allowed our ancestors to justify our activities and our reasons for doing things. It's like we're looking for an excuse. And so when one comes along, we take it. We look for an excuse to hate. And once we've got that excuse, we can do whatever we want. That seems to be what happens throughout history. We step into somebody's backyard and we say, hey, we're here in peace. And when we're told, okay, that's all right, we say, okay, we're good. We have our excuse to be here. And the moment one person from that group comes in to steal a cattle or whatever, we say, this is an act of war. And we step in and we wipe them off the planet. That's not okay. That is not okay. And I know it's much more complicated than that. Much more complicated. And I know there is a great deal more going on behind the scenes in every situation. That's what kind of comes down to what we're talking about. We don't know everything. We're in this mortal life. We don't know what's really going on. But how often can we give people the benefit of the doubt? Fight the wrongs that they're doing and not the people that are doing it. Bring the people to justice that need to be brought to justice, but not let hatred drive our decisions. We've got a long way to go, you guys, but we have to be working at it. We have to bring about a united world, and it's not going to happen by making the same mistakes that we've made throughout history of thinking all we got to do is get people to think and feel and act like we do. Because not only does that not work, that's just what hatred has always done. Let's explore love from its true perspective. Let's look on one another with genuine concern, genuine empathy. Seek to understand one another. And maybe, just maybe, this unity, this connection with all other beings may be able to once again happen. And I think once we do, we'll be able to see that it goes far beyond just our fellow human beings. Only we can do it. And only we can expect it of ourselves. So let's do it. If you would like to reach out to me, you can email me, Chaz, C-H-A-S, at ndepodcast.org. You can also email John at ndepodcast.org. You can support the podcast by buying my book or my album, both of which are available on neardeathexperiencepodcast.org, and then click on store. Or you can support the podcast by going to patreon.com/ndepodcast and becoming an ongoing monthly contributor. And with that, you guys, thank you. Thank you, thank you, thank you so much for listening.